Adagio.
Thank you for tuning in to WPVMLP Asheville, North Carolina, 103.7. Streaming online, WPVMFM.org. The voice of Asheville, heard all over the world.
This is WPVM 103.7 FM in Asheville, North Carolina. Hello and welcome to A Better World, coming to you from the studios of WPVM FM. My name is McNair Ezard and I'm your host for today's show. We come to you every Thursday afternoon from 5 to 6 p.m. at 103.7, or you can stream us live at WPVMFM.org. Each week, we take an in-depth look at the people and organizations locally, nationally, and internationally who are working to create a world that works for everyone, whether it be those who are working in the areas of hunger and poverty, economic and social justice, healthcare, education, housing, restoration of the environment, or those people and organizations who bring a fresh perspective to spirituality. A Better World features positive interviews with people who are making a difference. And today our guest is Marie Dennis of Pax Christi International. Marie is the author or co-author of 7 books, including Oscar Romero, Reflections on His Life and Writings, and also St. Francis and the Foolishness of God. She's also a contributing editor to Sojourners Magazine. Among her many accomplishments was her service on the White House Task Force on Global Poverty and Development. Welcome to the show, Marie.
Thank you very much.
Okay to refer to you as Marie?
Certainly.
Great. So first of all, tell us, what is Pax Christi International?
Pax Christi International is a Catholic peace movement that was founded at the end of the Second World War to promote reconciliation between the French and the Germans. It was started by a local group of French women, mostly women, who realized that in the wake of so many years of war and so many repeated wars, that they were going to have to find a way to interact in a positive way with their German neighbors. So Pax Christi was founded then. We are now present on 5 continents. We have 120 member organizations, all working for peace and reconciliation with a common commitment to nonviolence. Our work is very grassroots oriented, so the work for peace looks different depending on the context of a given country or region.
And is it ecumenically inclined?
It is still predominantly a Catholic peace movement, although in many places our membership is ecumenical, and we work almost all the time with people of other faith traditions and with many people of goodwill who are not particularly inspired by faith.
Okay. I mentioned some of your accomplishments in the intro, but tell us a bit about your background.
Well, I'm a lay woman, Catholic. I have 6 adult children and 9 grandchildren. I have been involved in work for peace, social justice, and respect for the integrity of creation for probably 40 years, so long time. Mm-hmm. I have worked for many years, about 25 years, for Mary Knoll, which is a Catholic missionary, set of Catholic missionary organizations, and was director of their Office for Global Concerns. A great deal of my work over the years has been in an effort to bring the experience of local communities into the process of shaping public opinion or public policy in the United States. So my advocacy at the U.S. government, the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, the United Nations has always been representative of the work of grassroots communities in different parts of the world who were recognizing that there were international roots to the problems that they were facing in terms of poverty, or violence and so on. Mm-hmm.
So you're on the road quite a bit, I would imagine.
I am, yes, I am on the road a lot. Both, I was for Marinol. Marinol works all over the world, and I, in order to understand the reality where they were working, I spent a lot of time visiting local communities. And now, as co-president of Pax Christi, yes, I'm on the road a lot.
So was there a defining moment in your life when you decided that working for peace and justice and on poverty issues was a worthwhile activity for you?
Yes, I would say, although probably it was more of a process over a period of time than one particular moment. But I think one of the driving elements for me was recognizing that in our own communities, I was then living in Virginia, in northwestern Virginia, and recognizing that in our own communities, there are many people who are not surviving very well, who are struggling to just put food on the table and keep a roof over their heads. And I began to think then about, yes, about how to help, but perhaps more importantly about what were the root causes of the poverty that you could see in the community where I was living. It was also at that time that the Catholic Church had just finished what was a tremendously important meeting, the Second Vatican Council, when the theology of our church shifted from having a very strong focus on personal spirituality, personal salvation, if you will, to recognizing that to be faithful as a Christian in this case, that we needed to be about making the world a more just and peaceful place. And so I had both strong encouragement and impetus from the faith tradition that I had grown up in, and also an opportunity to just look around the community where I was living and recognize that there were examples of structural and systemic injustice that were very visible.
One of your books was about Oscar Romero, and I understand he had a difficult time with Vatican II, and he was pretty conservative.
Yes, well, he was at first. In fact, he was always, he was a very traditional pastor. He was very deeply affected by what he saw around him. So as the repression in El Salvador intensified in the 70s, then Bishop Romero began to listen very closely to the experience, especially of the farm workers in his diocese, and began to recognize that that there were very serious problems that he, as a spokesperson for the church in that country, needed to address. He also was very affected by the assassination of a very close friend of his, who was a Jesuit, killed very brutally because he sided with marginalized and poor people in his mm-hmm. parish. So Romero actually became a very strong, powerful prophet in his own country. He always had friends who were part of the oligarchy, part of the upper class, and it was, I think, very painful for him to recognize the role that some of them were playing in what was a brutal repression against mm-hmm. poor people. But as he listened, and his door, after he was ordained the Archbishop of San Salvador, he listened day after day after day to the stories of poor people whose family members were disappearing, and was just incensed by that reality and began to speak out, which, mm-hmm. of course, ultimately led to his own assassination.
Did you ever meet him?
I didn't, no. Mm-hmm. I spent a lot of time in El Salvador, but I really didn't go there until after he was killed.
Mm-hmm. You know, he was one who spoke truth to power, is a more modern phrase, but what do you think when today you see those in power who are oppressing people, who speak up about injustice? I mean, it's happening right now in Honduras.
The challenge continues. Mm. I believe that those of us who care deeply about creating a more just and peaceful world also need to speak truth to power, and we need to accompany, stand beside, and support those people whose lives are in danger. For example, in Honduras, we just commemorated the one-year anniversary of the assassination of Berta Cáceres, who was a very powerful, beautiful woman, indigenous leader, assassinated last year. We absolutely must speak out, not only to the immediate people in the immediate situation who have power over those who are being harmed, but also we must look at the responsibility of our own society and of the international community in supporting that kind of violence and repression.
Is the Catholic Church divided on the approach? I mean, the more Archbishop Romero pre-social justice interest versus like Pope Francis, who's very out front about these issues?
Yes, of course. There are many different points of view in the Catholic community. But I do think, and I think that not only are there different points of view, but each one of us is hopefully always growing and open to changing our perspective. So I believe that wherever the church is present at the margins of society, wherever the church is understanding and experiencing the violence against particular groups of people, the church there is more likely to speak out, to be prophetic. I was recently in the Philippines and saw local parishes in the Philippines, especially those in communities where the present government of the Philippines is arranging for the assassination of anyone accused of using drugs. I saw the really remarkable commitment of a church that was responding because they knew by name and face people who were being put on death, the lists of for death squads. So I think that the church, the closer we get to the consequences of violence and oppression, the more likely we are to speak out. There are many in the church now who are doing that, and there are some who don't see it as a priority.
You recently gave some public talk in our time together. I'm hoping I can ask you about those. One of your talk titles was War No More, The Path to Nonviolence. What was that talk about?
Pax Christi International has been working for peace, as I said, and reconciliation for over 70 years. But we have around the world a common commitment to nonviolence. By nonviolence, we do mean a spirituality and a way of life that people adopt in terms of how they interact with others in their own neighborhood and community. But we also recognize that nonviolence, that there are many nonviolent approaches, many nonviolent strategies that have been proven to be effective in dealing with some of the more violent and dangerous situations that we have in the world. So for the last 5 years or so, we have been engaging the institutional Catholic Church to encourage the church to move beyond the language of just war, to talk about, to teach, and to invest in the development of effective nonviolent strategies that that could very often preclude the necessity of any kind of military action. We're talking about nonviolence as everything from diplomacy to trauma healing, from civilian resistance to nonviolent protection of communities to restorative justice. So nonviolence in a very broad way, but we believe deeply that nonviolent strategies could actually make war unnecessary and obsolete 95% of the time.
I mean, with war as an option, I mean, we can destroy each other with a touch of a button these days, so we have to find a way to move away from that precipice. I think you're right.
Absolutely. Yeah. The other dimension in that same talk that I focused on was the challenge of nuclear weapons that we are facing again at this time in a very dangerous way. So absolutely, we have no choice but to find mm-hmm. other routes than war to solve the problems in the world. But that is not being naive about pretending that somehow the world will suddenly be pacifist and we won't have to deal with dangerous situations anymore. The question is not, do we have to stop violence? Do we have to, whether or not we have to protect people? The question is how we do that.
Mm-hmm. Okay, on that note, let me just take a quick station identification. If you just joined us, you're listening to a conversation with Marie Dennis of Pax Christi International. And you're listening to us on A Better World at 103.7 WPVM FM and streaming live at WPVMFM.org.
Maria, grazia plena. Maria, grazia plena. Maria, grazia plena. Ave, ave Domino.
Marie, I wanted to ask you about the struggle for a nonviolent path, particularly here in the United States. I recently read a report, I think it was put out by the Institute for Economics and Peace, that said out of 163 states or territories around the world, it ranked the United States at 103, just behind Uganda and Guinea. We have this history in this country of bullying a lot of countries and getting involved or initiating conflict. Any sense of why that is?
That's a very hard question to answer. Mm-hmm. I don't know that anybody can actually put their finger on exactly why we have ended up in such a really troubling place. But I suspect that there are many factors involved. I think one of them is our inclination to focus or emphasize individualism, that we have a tendency to think that my rights, my needs, my way of doing things always has to be possible. And I don't think we're as good as we could be at promoting the common good. So in the debate that we're having now, which of course touches on another reason why I believe there is such violence, such destructive violence in our country right now, is that we seem to have an inability to reach an answer to how we deal with guns of all kinds that actually acknowledges the need for the common good. We think so much about what I can do, what I need to do, that I just don't think we are framing very well the need to develop laws and practices that actually protect and ensure mm-hmm. the common good. So it is an interesting question, especially in the framework of nonviolence, which is so much the focus of Pax Christi right now, because I think in order to move to another place, that we do need to begin with both the personal practice of nonviolence, beginning with how we talk to each other, with mm-hmm. how we listen to each other. Mm-hmm. So learning the skill of nonviolent communications could go a long way to helping us move to another place. I also believe that another step that we could be taking, and I think many people are. I am hopeful about the future, but it seems to me that that we need to teach our children at a very, very young age how to do that, how to communicate with each other in a way that doesn't avoid conflict, because that's impossible. We will always have conflict in our in our families, our society, in our world. But the question is how to deal with that conflict. And there are ways to do it that respect the other person, that claim our own dignity. So that's one thing. And I think the other is that for whatever reason, we seem to have lost a sense of the inherent dignity of every person. And that is another lesson that begins at an early age, as we begin to understand that each person, that I included, have inherent dignity. And that then, I think, helps us recognize that in every other human being, there is something unique and precious that, that needs to be respected. We seem to have lost a sense of that, and we're not the only place in the world that is missing that sort of way of honoring life, and I mean the life of every person. But I think it's come to a place in our own country that it appears that some groups of people or some individuals are disposable, that that we can create policies that that exclude people from meaningful participation in our society, and then with a plethora of guns everywhere, open the door to either a reaction to that or a furthering of that kind of thinking.
Does your sense of the inherent worth of the individual, does that stem from your faith? Do you see people with no faith background also having that belief in the inherent dignity of people?
Absolutely, yes. My personal belief in the inherent worth and dignity of each person does stem from my faith. It's a very deep belief in many faith traditions, including my own. But I tend to express that belief as each person has unique value in the eyes of God. But I absolutely believe, and I see it in practice all the time, that people who don't claim a faith motivation for what they're doing, who also know that other human beings have great dignity. I think that probably for me the challenging piece is it's one thing to believe that the person in front of me has dignity, or that people I know have dignity, or that people I respect have dignity. What I think is much harder to do is to also recognize that people whose behavior I see as extremely evil, violent, and dangerous also have dignity. And I think that it is a great challenge to our world and to our society to recognize that dignity even in the worst extremist or the person with whom I disagree most vehemently.
And that, I think, that takes a certain level of detachment and forgiveness on someone's part to be able to do that.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's not, and I don't think it's not about an emotional response, mm-hmm. because we have a natural emotional revulsion to evil and to evil behavior. I think it is a choice. It's a decision to believe that that the worst terrorist as a human being has innate essential dignity in the same way that my children and grandchildren do.
Mm-hmm. This is probably a good place to ask you about the relationship between a person's interior life of prayer and meditation, if they have one, and their life of activism. In your mind, what should that relationship look like to you?
I actually believe that the answer to that question is probably different for each person. Yes, I think that we each do need to have a way of nourishing our spirituality, whatever that looks like. The spiritual side of us needs attention. But I also do believe that different people, different personalities, people with different belief systems, both find that kind of nourishment in different ways, and also are often nourished by engagement in good work. In many ways, in my own journey, I find a tremendous spiritual nourishment as well as satisfaction, happiness in the work that I've done for peace, for social justice, for respect for creation. Mm-hmm. So, yes, I think both dimensions are important, but I think each person needs to find the balance that mm-hmm. works for him mm-hmm. or her, and then have the space to live that out.
Let me ask you about something that you mentioned earlier about the nuclear weapons. The United Nations passed the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons, or the Nuclear Weapon Ban Treaty, and many countries signed that. The U.S. still has not signed. Do you see any signs that eventually the U.S. will sign that treaty? I mean, China hasn't signed it, I don't think, or Russia, and certainly North Korea.
None of the nuclear weapon states have signed the treaty. In fact, I don't think any of the states that consider themselves to be protected by the nuclear umbrella have signed it. I have hope that someday they will. I think that sometimes the first step in moving toward a positive resolution of a very serious problem is for some people, some countries, to step out and begin moving in the right direction. The ban treaty, the nuclear weapons ban treaty, actually is a phenomenal example of what I think is a very positive sign of what maturity among the family of nations. In the last few years, the nations of the world have begun to look at the humanitarian consequences of any use of nuclear weapons. Recognition that even a limited exchange of nuclear weapons could provoke a catastrophe, including climate change, that would be astronomical. And countries of the world that do not possess nuclear weapons have began to address that, to say, if there's an exchange of these weapons, we all will pay a terrible price. And in fact, as we know, nuclear weapons are one of two existential threats to the inhabitability of this planet, the other being climate change. So the non-nuclear weapons states came together in three different humanitarian consequences conferences and made a commitment to negotiate a treaty that would make the nuclear weapons, the possession, the development, certainly the use of nuclear weapons, illegal at an international level, was a tremendous, wonderful accomplishment. They recognized that other weapons of mass destruction, chemical and biological weapons and so on, have been banned for a long time, that we've actually been able to ban weapons that have extremely serious consequences in civilian communities, like cluster bombs and anti-personnel landmines, but that there was no ban on nuclear weapons. So to have initiated that process and to have accomplished it in a relatively short time, really just two negotiating sessions, was a tremendous accomplishment. As a member of the ICANN, the Nobel laureate winning organization, Pax Christi was very deeply involved in the civil society engagement around the ban treaty. Whether the United States and other nuclear weapons states will ever move in that direction, it's still a long way off. They're not even in the conversation yet, but I'm hopeful that someday they will. What has been interesting for those of us in the Catholic tradition is that the Holy See, which has a observer status at the United Nations, was very deeply involved in promoting the nuclear ban treaty, in negotiating it, and I think that they actually were the first to sign and ratify the treaty.
on that note, we'll take a short break here, and you're listening to us on WPVM 103.7 FM in Asheville and streaming live at WPVMFM.org. And we'll be back with our guest, Marie Dennis of Pax Christi International. We'll be back with Marie in just a few minutes after this musical break.
Why can't we be humble like the good Lord said? He promised to exalt us, but low is the way. How men be so greedy when there's so much left? All things God given, and they all have been blessed. That's the way. Your heart be troubled, let mourning sobbing cease. Learn how to help one another and live in perfect peace. If we all just be humble, like the good Lord said, He promised to exalt us.
Okay, welcome back. That was That's the Way God Planned It by Billy Preston. That was from the Concert for Bangladesh album that was released in 1971. And this is McNair Ezard. And our guest today is Marie Dennis of Pax Christi International. She's also written several books, one of which is Oscar Romero, Reflections on His Life and Writings, and another book, St. Francis and the Foolishness of God. Marie, I wanted to ask you about another talk. I think it was titled The Gospel Call to Peace and Reconciliation. What was the theme of that talk?
The theme of that talk was nonviolence. It was a kind of general approach to deeper understanding of what nonviolence is. As I was saying before, the common perception of nonviolence is either that it is a personal spirituality that is irrelevant in the public arena, or that it is chaining yourself to the fence or demonstrating in front of a federal building. But in reality, nonviolence, active nonviolence, nonviolent strategies have been proven to be mm-hmm. a very effective approach to accomplishing justice in the public arena. So, for example, a very interesting empirical study recently done by Maria Steffen and Erica Chenoweth, and then written up in their book called Why Civil Resistance Works, demonstrated that over the hundreds of conflicts, violent conflicts or nonviolent conflicts in the 20th century, that when there was an organized resistance to a dictator or to an oppressive government or to accomplish a very often very substantial kind of change in a particular country or situation, that nonviolent strategies were twice as effective as violence. And we believe that, and what I was talking about is the belief that if we invested as a world in developing and scaling up nonviolent strategies, that we much, much more often could accomplish even even very difficult tasks nonviolently. So, for example, for decades, the United Nations has been attempting to resolve situations of violence and threatening situations in particular circumstances by sending peacekeeping forces to a particular country. Often they have been not had enough resources to do their job. They've often not had a clear mandate, but almost never have they engaged the possibility of nonviolent forces to protect local communities that are in danger. Yet non-governmental organizations like Nonviolent Peace Force and Christian Peacemaker Teams and many others have been doing that at a small scale in very particular circumstances over many, many years. We believe that, for example, the United States is now going to spend $700 billion a year preparing for war. If we spent some portion of that, a significant portion of that, actually investing in and scaling up nonviolent alternatives, we could probably respond nonviolently much more often, even in very difficult situations. There have been a few small programs housed in the U.S. State Department over the last few years that have focused on atrocity prevention, for example. Could we do a better job of predicting when a situation was becoming very dangerous and intervening in a way, not as the United States, but as an international community that cares about peace, to prevent atrocities and terrible situations? We have had also a very small, flexible fund, the Complex Crisis Fund, in the U.S. toolbox that has been extremely small, not scaled up enough to really function, but has still done some very important work in very dangerous situations. We have just failed to invest in other than violent tools for responding to a world that is admittedly very dangerous. So our commitment, and this is what I was talking about the other night, our commitment as Pax Christi International is to encourage nations of the world and the Catholic Church to teach about nonviolence, to invest in nonviolence, to advocate for nonviolent alternatives at whatever level we're working. An interesting example is another, the United Nations did an independent review of all of its peace operations. So the peacekeeping, the area that is called the responsibility to protect, and peace building operations. And after a very careful review, what the direction that was recommended by this independent panel was to focus on what they called sustaining peace, meaning that you don't just respond to dangerous situations at a moment of crisis or try to pick up the pieces after war, but that we know what makes for peace. We know that access to jobs, that just economic situations, that even attending to the damage that is already being done by extremes of climate and so on, that long-term work that is sustained and to which there is a commitment over years is what will actually build peace, and that we can't only come into crisis situations like the Yazidis caught on top of the mountain in northern Iraq a few years ago and recognize that we have no other tools but the tools of military action.
Yeah, and as long as we have this discrepancy between the haves and the have-nots in the world, I don't think we'll ever have justice. And like you said, we'll never have peace unless we have the justice.
Exactly. I think what we're recognizing more and more, and you mentioned Pope Francis earlier, he has actually been a very clear advocate for recognizing that the root causes of poverty, environmental destruction, and war are interconnected. Those huge problems that the world deals with, from economic injustice to climate change to violence, are often connected to the same roots and connected to each other. So, for example, the damage done by climate change, the fact that in many countries there is that already are losing significant land mass to the sea and so on and on and on, that is likely to be a provocation for violent conflict and war in the future. Losing our sources of fresh water, our land, even not just to the sea, but losing land is often a source of conflict, and that the solution to these problems then has to be sought together with lots of connections among the issues. Pope Francis talks about integral ecology. In that phrase, he wraps together a multitude of interconnected problems.
Okay, we're coming up on 3:15, and you're listening to A Better World, coming to you from the studios of WPVM 103.7 FM. And we're streaming live at WPVMFM.org, which is where you can also access our previous shows archived for your enjoyment at any time. Check our schedule for this and other great programs at WPVMFM.org.
Gravity is working against me.
And if you just joined us, you're listening to a conversation with Marie Dennis of Pax Christi International and a contributing editor, actually, to Sojourners Magazine. And she has served in the past on the White House Task Force on Global Poverty and Development. Marie, you've done a lot of work in poverty and injustice issues. We in this world, we still have, I think, 800 million people who are living on less than $1.90 a day. Do you think we just lack the political will to end poverty once and for all? Or what's behind this ongoing tragedy for people?
Yes, I think we lack the political will, and I think we have, especially over the last 30 years, developed and promoted around the world a model of economic life that benefits a very few people and leaves many, many people excluded. So I think the imbalance in our world, the power imbalance and the wealth imbalance is what is perpetuating poverty. So poverty is not an act of God. It is not. It does not only come from natural disasters that were somehow unavoidable. It is the result of economic, financial decisions that are made to the benefit of a very small number of people and to the detriment of millions.
So what kind of change do you think we need in our economic system?
That's a really big question. I spent a lot of years looking at, for example, the indebtedness of very poor countries and how we needed to change the model of economic life to help them find a way out of that indebtedness. And then I spent many years following the negotiation of some of the major trade agreements that have been developed over the last many years. I find it very interesting now that the current administration is criticizing some of the trade agreements in which the United States is a partner, but criticizing it from the exactly opposite end of what I would say, which is I believe that our trade agreements that have helped shape the role that different countries and different sectors of even populations within a country, the role that they would play in economic life. And I believe that most of the trade agreements that were developed, especially between the North and the South, the hemispheres over the last 30 years, were tremendously advantageous to the North and often disadvantageous to the global South. So the depth of the work that needs to be done is profound in terms of the pursuit of economic justice. I think that, yes, we do need to continue to provide whatever assistance we can provide to people who are on the margins in our own society, as well as to people in other parts of the world. But that is putting Band-Aids on a very deep wound. And until the nations of the world, until powerful corporations, until the people of the world decide that we need to find a more just model of economic life, I'm not sure we'll solve this problem.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I've heard read a lot lately about people calling for sharing the resources of the world on a more equitable playing field so that everybody has the needed resources they need to have a life, and we don't have that right now.
Absolutely.
The developed world hogs all the goodies for itself.
It's one of I think, very shocking things that I have seen in the last few years was a map of mining rights given to foreign companies to explore for minerals in a particular country in Latin America. And it looked like Swiss cheese, you know, that every square mile would have a mine dug to extract minerals. What you said is absolutely right at a mega level, that right now one of the main sources of violence in many countries is around mining, and it's a very complicated issue, and it's not going to be simply solved. But the reality is that in almost every part of the Southern Hemisphere, and in many other places as well, we are rapidly extracting the natural resources that are the root of our own development, so to speak, and that simply won't be there when other peoples in other and other countries are coming to a place where they need them for their own to build their own economies and so on. So, it's one part of the picture that's huge.
Well, speaking generally, because you can always point out particular people or organizations in a country, but is there a general sense of complacency on the part of those in the developed world towards the poor in the developing countries, do you think? Like, as long as I've got what I need and I'm okay, the rest of the world can go hang?
Yes, I think that happens a lot, yes. But I also see many, many people who are deeply concerned and who, although sometimes the information and the analysis is not easy to get, that we don't ask why often enough. Why are there poor people in this part of the world or that part of the world? Why is there poverty around? Why is the Democratic Republic of the Congo, for example, in perpetual war and dealing with terrible poverty when it holds some of the most incredibly rich natural resources anywhere? We don't ask why, and we don't get that analysis. But still, there are many, many people, many organizations who are doing great work to resolve some of these huge problems. They are not, obviously, not all in the global north. There are many gifted, talented people and great organizations that are functioning in very poor countries or poor regions of the world who are solving their own problems and not waiting for us to do that. I think sometimes we can follow the lead of others.
Do you ever get discouraged in your work?
Yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm. I get discouraged. But I think I do hold on to a lot of hope. I'm not an optimist necessarily, probably too realistic for that. But I have seen change in my life, and I am hopeful that we will find ways to create a better world and to resolve some of the really significant, deep injustices that are so often the root of violence and war.
Have you met Pope Francis yourself?
I have, yes. Mm-hmm. I've met him 3 times.
And your impression?
He just was a lovely, welcoming, a very humble man. I think that his personal persona conveys very well in most of his actions. I think that he's been an inspiration in many directions. Not perfect, but an inspiration.
I mean, he and the Dalai Lama are two of the chief people I see standing up for the poor and injustice and creation and such.
Yes, and I think he has done that well. He has an instinct for beginning with experience. So the real experience, for example, of migrants, of people who are very poor, street people in Rome, for example, really touch him and guide his moral compass, if you will, in making recommendations and taking action. So, for example, on a personal level, he does things like had a shower built in the Vatican for street people in Rome, and he brought to the Vatican City some migrants, I think from Syria and so on, and he does translate that into openness in listening to new ideas.
We just got a little bit of time left. I wanted to ask you a couple of more questions, one of which has to do with one of your books, Saint Francis and the Foolishness of God. It's easy for people to get lost in the theology of the church or even of Saint Francis. What would you say is the simple message of Saint Francis that is appropriate for our world today?
Saint Francis' message was very clear. It called for us as people of faith to respond to poverty, to eradicate poverty, to treat the natural world with respect, and to end war. It was how he lived his life, and it's what his message to us is.
Well, the part about treating the poor appropriately and such, is that also the message that Archbishop Oscar Romero brought?
Absolutely, yes. Over the last number of decades, the Catholic Church has been focusing, including in other directions, has been focusing its work on a preferential option for the poor. That is what motivated Francis. It is what motivated Romero. And it is a direction in which all who are part of our faith tradition are encouraged to go. So, yes, Romero's life was ultimately given in support of the most impoverished people in his society. And we are called to, in whatever ways we can, follow his lead.
We're unfortunately coming near the end of the hour in our conversation with Marie Dennis. Marie Dennis, how can people find out more about the work you do?
In the United States, our member organization is Pax Christi USA. Their website is www.paxchristiusa.org. Internationally, our international Pax Christi website is www.paxchristi.net. We hope you'll go there and learn more about us and join our work.
Do you have any final thoughts you'd like to share?
Perhaps my final thoughts are really words of hope. I think that it is time for all of us to participate in whatever ways we can in learning and in practicing nonviolent approaches to the world in which we live in, both to other people and to the rest of creation. I think that would go a long way in improving the very difficult reality that we too often see around us.
For those people who look at the world and they see the problems as insurmountable and their effort as would hardly make a dent, what can you say for encouragement?
Great question. I believe that the most that we can do in any case is to take the next right step. And so any step that contributes to a more peaceful neighborhood, a more peaceful family, a more just society in any way makes a very significant contribution. So don't think that you have to leap over the wall. All you need to do is to take the next right step in the way you are and how you relate to everyone and everything around you.
Marie Dennis of Pax Christi International and a contributing editor to Sojourners Magazine, thank you for being on the show today. It's been great hearing about your work.
You're very welcome. Thank you for asking me. Thank you.
You've been listening to A Better World on 103.7 WPVM FM, brought to you each Thursday afternoon from 5 to 6 p.m. This is McNair Ezard. Thank you for joining us, and hopefully we'll see you next week on A Better World. And we're going out today with Ziggy Marley, Love Is My Religion.
All my days I've been searching to find out what this life is worth. Through the books and Bibles of time, I've made up my mind. I don't condemn, I don't convert. This is a calling, have you heard? Bring all the lovers to the fold, 'cause no one is gonna lose their soul. Take it or leave.
So don't let nobody stop us. Free spirits have to soar.